This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with SG2 experts and industry thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery. We're always looking for new ideas and topics from our listeners, so please reach out, share your ideas. You can email us at sg2perspectives@sg2.com or connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter, and you can find links to all that in the show notes. Now, on to this week's episode.
Welcome to SG2 Perspectives. This is part one of a two-part series. I am your host, Kelly Richard, and today we'll be talking disruptors. With me today, we have our foremost thinker on innovation and technology, principal on the Intel team, Henry Sock, our virtual health expert, senior director, Chris Pagano, and our medicine and surgery service line lead and resident scientist, director, Justin Cassidy. Henry, Chris, and Justin just appeared on our annual Disruptors webinar, where they discussed the most disruptive forces in healthcare via a panel format of a discussion. It was fantastic. And if you're an SG2 member, we highly recommend that you log into the website and check that out. Thank you for being here today.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Kelly.
Let's go ahead and just say it. COVID-19 has been just about the most disruptive force that has impacted the healthcare industry in our lifetime. And I don't think I'm being cliche when I say that it's into causing a lot of tragedy. It's also created a lot of innovation in science, clinical medicine, technology, operations, and even business models. We can't cover all of that today. So we'll just try to focus on a couple of key areas and hopefully span multiple areas of disruption. I want to start first at sort of the core challenge of COVID-19, and that's that it's a novel virus. And we've had to innovate from a clinical research perspective in order to address this virus. Justin, let's go to you first. Can you just tell us a little bit about some of the disruption that we've seen from COVID as a novel virus and how we've addressed it in disruptive ways?
Well, Kelly, there's been so much in the last year. It's really hard to put a finger on exactly what's happening because the number of studies on COVID-19 that have been published in the last year, according to the Dimensions database, it's been over 310,000 publications, most in preprint journals. And some have lamented this so-called COVIDification of scientific endeavors. To get at that uncertainty amidst the pandemic, we're starting to get the answers to what are lingering questions regarding reinfection rates, durability of vaccines, seasonality of the virus, and emerging viral variants. More than anything, and I speak from experience, scientists are really bad at getting at the big picture. We thought in 2020 was the vaccine is a panacea. In 2021, we realized that it is vaccination, and we hope that in 2022, we'll be able to go on vacation after all of this is over.
I need a vacation. I know that. Henry.
I think we all do.
Absolutely. Henry, when you think sort of about the way that the virus is being addressed from a technology perspective, what are your thoughts?
What was interesting to me is that from a technology perspective, if you look at what's happened since the pandemic started, we've increased our sequencing capability by a factor of 10. And that was kind of reinforced in a press release or a press conference yesterday with Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins from NIH. It's good for us because as these variants now come around, we're able to kind of sequence them rapidly and find out whether or not we need to take action against that. So that's been encouraging to me. The second thing has been the use of machine learning, artificial intelligence, and these so-called generational adversarial networks allow us to begin to model what's happening in terms of some of the pandemics, and also to allow us to identify new targets for vaccine development. So one of the encouraging things that I heard from Dr. Collins yesterday was that if there is a vaccine variant that requires a change in scope in terms of the vaccine or a new target, we can get there within 6 weeks after we sequence the new variant. So that is good news that the science works from there. The last thing from my perspective is we've kind of used some modified crowdsourcing to identify spikes as they become available. So that's become much more prevalent, and it helps us to identify where the areas are that we need to concentrate our efforts in reducing the number of cases that we have.
Absolutely. It really is truly amazing because prior to this, in terms of creating vaccines, wasn't it a 4-year process or something? Is that the last one or the quickest maybe we've created one most recently?
If you look at the timeline since December of 2019, when we kind of first identified this, it's just amazing that we've gotten to two cleared messenger RNA vaccines in under a year, or just a little bit over a year. If you look at the normal kind of drug development cycle, and Justin can speak to this better than I, you're looking at 8, 10, 15 years. So the fact that we've gotten to two cleared vaccines and on the verge of a third one in the span of time that we have is very impressive to me.
Yeah, the vaccine platforms themselves have been truly disruptive. Certainly two vaccine developments, we see Merck pulling out of the COVID-19 vaccine game. Moving forward, we're going to see a lot more mRNA vaccines. Moderna's pipeline is full of amazing innovations, flu, HIV, Nipah virus, CMV, EBV, the list goes on for common colds, flu, Zika, also for cancer, solid tumor targeting, and even for genetic diseases.
Justin, you mentioned Merck pulling out from the COVID vaccines, but the good news from the pandemic perspective is now they're talking about helping with the manufacturing side and helping to manufacture the existing vaccines that are clear to get us to more doses more rapidly. Pharmaceutical companies that were formerly competitors now are coming together to be able to increase our ability to vaccinate the population, which I think is another positive result from this.
Certainly. And it also allows them to double down on new meds that would perhaps serve as pre-exposure prophylaxis for COVID-19 that we may have results for in the next few months. That could be really, truly a game changer, an extra layer of protection, along with public health measures, the vaccine, and a potentially new drug.
What I'm hearing is the science that we've been able to pull off in a short period of time is nothing short of amazing and miraculous. But then there's the other side. When you figure out how you're going to address the virus, how do you operationalize that? There have been challenges in delivering care to patients. Have we seen health systems, as well as other new entrants that have innovated, address those challenges?
Maybe from the technology side, Kelly, what's been interesting to me, looking at kind of the role of medical imaging in the management of COVID patients, we've seen some amazing innovation in terms of how do we deliver those? How do we get those studies done? This concept of bringing imaging to the patient because of the transmission concerns, instead of bringing the patient to radiology, we brought radiology to the patient. We found a way to be able to do those digital chest x-rays through glass windows or through the doors to be able to acquire the information. There's been a tremendous uptick in the utilization of point of care handheld ultrasound as a tool in the emergency departments when patients present to the emergency department, and then on the floors to be able to use that technology to assess potential damage in the lungs, especially at the periphery of the lungs. And then the third thing has been recent development of kind of portable MRI to bring that to the patient, because we know that in some patients there are neurological issues that arise as a result of the coronavirus. Again, bringing the technology to the patient. I was just on a panel discussion with some imaging radiology managers from our members organizations, and they expect that new trend of bringing imaging to the patient and maybe extending that outside of the four walls of the hospital now to bring some imaging back into the home will continue as we move along with this. That's been positive. Second thing has been the increased use in 3D printing. Early on, when we had the problem with ventilator supplies and PPE shortages, we saw that a lot of organizations took advantage of 3D printing to be able to either print face shields for their staff, connection devices so that we could put two patients on a single ventilator to minimize the shortages that are there. We may talk a little bit later on about the increased use in sensor technology, remote patient monitoring and sensors, the increased development in on-body sensors to be able to manage and monitor those patients remotely without having to have a care team go into the room. And it's even as simple as taking the controls for an IV or the ventilator outside of the room and putting it in the hallway so that we're not having to have somebody gown up and go into the room. There's been a tremendous amount of innovation on the care delivery side.
I think the overarching theme, Henry, that you're discussing here around bringing care to the patient, I think that's going to continue. And your point's well taken here is that that doesn't just exist within the four walls of the hospital. It extends outside the four walls of the hospital. We've seen that obviously on the virtual health front. Needless to say, 2020 was a pretty significant banner year for uptake around that area. And you know, yes, we've seen some of that volume pull back to an extent. But for a lot of organizations and in a lot of markets, it's actually persisted. Even as in-person visit volumes have come back, the reality is that the sheer latent demand that exists in the market has allowed some organizations who have executed well in this space have been able to essentially stack those visit volumes on top of their in-person volumes. The challenge with that strategy is there is a clinical capacity challenge there. So what we've seen over the last year or so, probably going to continue to see this moving forward, is that there's been clinical capacity contraction overall. We're already hearing that there are many other physicians out there who are saying, look, we're going to get through COVID, but once we get through this COVID crisis, I'm going to be leaving the practice. We're going to continue to see that challenge persist, unfortunately. What that leads to is a lot of organizations are really thinking innovatively around how do we leverage technology to create efficiencies, to support our clinicians, not replace our clinicians, to support our clinicians, enhance their abilities and extend their reach. And we've seen this across the acuity continuum. For low acuity care, virtual health, that direct-to-consumer model has been tremendously valuable, but in particular, with chronic care patient populations, we've seen really significant advancements there as well. Lots of organizations are adopting remote patient monitoring. We're seeing that technology continue to evolve as well. So we're moving past kind of this utilization of current state or retrospective data to be able to tease out trends and try to anticipate when somebody is beginning to deteriorate and actually get to predictive data where we can identify patients who are likely to have their condition deteriorate and be able to intervene before that even happens. So we're already seeing some pretty dramatic advancements on the tech side that has a significant impact on how we deliver care. And the last point maybe I'd make here is we also are seeing the rise of hospital at home in a much more significant way than we've seen in the past. I was talking with one of our senior executives within one of our clients the other day, and he said something to the effect of, look, we can literally create 1,000 new beds without having to lay a brick if we adopt this technology.
Yeah, Chris, that's an excellent point. I love that you brought in, we're trying to make care that we provide to patients more patient-centric, bring it to them. But I think it's really important not to forget who's providing that care and any of these technologies that can kind of make that easier or make it more effective are really important. Thinking about a new patient cohort that we're going to kind of start seeing here. Millions of people have been diagnosed with COVID, have had the disease. So we're starting to see a new chronic patient that's coming in, the COVID-19 long hauler. In terms of having that new patient population and how they need to be cared for, what kind of disruption do you think they're going to cause and what do we need to meet it with?
Kelly, we're already seeing this, and it really kind of percolated from the bottom up with social media networks of patients that have recovered from COVID but are experiencing lingering symptoms more than 6 weeks out. These so-called COVID long haulers are networking with each other to try to get care that they need. They're actually conducting research studies, surveys amongst themselves. By far and away, the most reported symptom is fatigue. And so we think there's going to be certainly a surge of outpatient consults for fatigue moving forward. The symptoms span the gambit: cardiovascular, neurological, nephrology, endocrinology, pulmonology, and perhaps most importantly, behavioral health. As recovery is maybe not the same in everyone, there's a lot of uncertainty in the folks that have had the disease, and really just delivering empathetic care to this cohort is critical. And so what we've seen is the emergence of COVID long haul clinics emerge. And many of our leading clients, and we've been on the phone with so many at this point, the trends that they all share is with that long haul cohort, think about the longitudinal tracking that's necessary to care for these patients as we learn more about the disease in real time. Incorporating those changes into the clinical care pathways is really important, especially as we think about reinfection, but also about pre-infection. A lot of those risk factors that catalyze the development of severe COVID-19, namely obesity, hypertension, diabetes, those are often overrepresented in this recovering cohort. As those experiencing social determinants of health, several of these clinics are seeing a very high percentage of their patient cohort coming from minority populations. All of this needs to be wrapped up with really extensive care coordination efforts with those multidisciplinary teams, making that navigation very easy for patients to receive the services that they require. And then finally, the idea that you really have to think a lot more about the treatment cadence and choreography as emerging medicines are delivered, as vaccines are going to be delivered to these patients that have recovered, how might they respond differently? And being able to track this in real time in order to anticipate the sort of emergent need, for instance, reinfection with the new viral variant strains, we'll be learning very quickly if this patient cohort is vulnerable or perhaps hopefully more protected.
The other thing, Justin, that's interesting here is we have actually a really interesting opportunity with the COVID long haulers, which is historically when we have implemented new technologies, new capabilities, new innovations, there's been a pretty significant lift required in terms of change management. When we're trying to shift away from practices that have been in place for quite a while, that change management part of it can actually trip up a lot of organizations. There are a lot of innovative concepts that have been out there for a while that have been challenging to implement at scale because of some of this issue. And I think there's that where we might be able to move forward is we don't have to worry about that with COVID long haulers. We don't have a great handle on kind of what this condition is, how to really treat these patients effectively and what works and what doesn't. We actually could take the opportunity to start building these types of COVID long hauler clinics in a way that is more reflective of how we think we might want to deliver care in the future and almost use it in a way as a pilot site. And then the concepts that take hold, that work, that deliver value, we can apply those with evidence backing it to other areas of the organization.
This concludes part one of our two-part series on healthcare disruption. Please tune in next week for part two as we dig deep into data, as well as the issues you should be paying close attention to in the coming year. This has been another episode of SG2 Perspectives. If you like what you are hearing, please subscribe and don't forget to rate and review. We'd love to hear from you. Please connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter at SG2 Healthcare. You can also reach us via email at sg2perspectives@sg2.com. Reach out and let us know what healthcare trends are most important to you. Please also listen and subscribe to our colleague, Dr. Tom Villanueva's Modern Practice podcast on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. Tom discusses key healthcare trends through the clinical leadership lens. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening.